Welcome to the Off the Charts Football Podcast. I'm Matt Manicharian, former NFL scout and now of Sports Info Solutions, joined by Aaron Schatz, the godfather of football analytics and the founder of Football Outsiders. As always, we've got our producer, Justin Stein, with us. And later in the episode, we will have Nathan Cooper on for a film scouting breakdown, giving a little football rookie handbook preview. But it's midseason in the NFL season right now, and we are here to do our usual thing. Aaron, how's your week going? What are you thinking at the midway point?
I can't believe it's midseason. We actually made it. We made it without canceling any games. I don't know if we're going to make it the rest of the way without canceling any games, but we made it to midseason. It's amazing that it's week 10 already.
It feels like there are more college games being canceled than played this weekend. That's been an absolute nightmare to just keep track of. And from an operational standpoint, I feel bad for Dan Forenbach and him having to just manage all of that from a charting perspective.
Oh, yeah.
But hopefully this is a blip and we can get back on track. But we'll see.
The NFL is full speed ahead, though. I mean, you know, they've managed to play everything. We've managed to make it to midseason. The NFL is doing well.
It seems like there's definitely an argument that people are safer there than in other places.
Well, because they're not in college and they're not wanting to be college kids and mixing with other college kids.
And when you got to get tested every day and there's millions of dollars on the line and you don't want to be that guy, I think it makes a difference. All right. Anyway, let's get into the football, though. We've got some interesting games that we're discussing this week. Some that surprised me a little bit.
Yeah. Our most important game for the week is the Seattle Seahawks at the Los Angeles Rams. Big NFC West showdown in the best division in football. So Seattle makes the Super Bowl in 20% of our simulations if they win this game, 12.5% if they lose. The Rams make the Super Bowl 9.2% of the time if they win and 4.1% of the time if they lose.
And these teams are kind of neck and neck in the DVOA rankings. As you mentioned, the best division, most hotly contested division in football, where really all four teams are still in the mix. I'm not ready to count the Niners out quite yet. And then just the offense of the Seahawks has been great. Obviously, a little blip last week. Russell Wilson had by far his worst game of the season, just 1.5 passing points earned. The only worst game in his past two seasons was a -3 passing points earned game against the Niners in week 10 of 2019. But I don't think there's any concerns about him. The concerns from the Seattle side are the injuries and the defense, which I think are the two things that could really prevent them from being a contender when all is said and done.
So I'm going to like take a little bit of a time here and sort of defend the Seattle defense a little bit in that they are not the worst defense in the league. First of all, their defense has improved over the last few weeks. They were 28th in DVOA in weeks 1-4, but 16th in weeks 5-9. And the main reason why they've given up so many passing yards is not just that they're bad against the pass, it's that teams pass against them more than anybody else. So Seattle's pass defense is actually 26th in success rate and 28th in yards per dropback, but they've faced more passes than any other defense.
You know, it reminds me, I can't remember if it was when the Packers drafted A.J. Dillon or what it was, but at one point you asked me, should we be worried about a team that invests in running backs because they might be more likely to base their offense on their running game as opposed to the passing game, and that can be kind of a negative thing. I wonder what the Jamal Adams effect is on opposing offenses. When you bring in a player like him who's just so good in the run game and such a pass rusher and not a pass defender, I wonder if that's what's behind kind of everybody just wanting to be bombs away against the Seahawks. Obviously, it starts working and teams are going to do it even more. But it seems like philosophically, they're really built to be an 8-in-the-box team. And the opponents are saying, all right, we want to pass anyway.
Well, obviously, this doesn't relate to Adams because Adams has been out for a large part of the season. But Seattle's defensive DVOA is dead last if we're only looking at passes over the middle of the field. And by the way, the Rams are 7th on DVOA on passes over the middle and lead the NFL with 11.7 yards per pass on passes over the middle.
So that's interesting. So that brings up an interesting kind of matchup that I wanted to look into because I went straight into breaking down, you know, the Seahawks pass defense, what's been going on. because I think that's what it comes down to in this game. Every part of me thinks that the Seahawks are a better team than the Rams, but that is certainly a big hole. So I started looking into some of their splits. They don't like to play man very much, and with good reason. They have -3 pass defense points saved on 69 man coverage snaps this year. So count out the Seahawks playing man, which I think kind of makes sense if you understand what they're doing. So they play more zone than anybody in the NFL, just over half of which is their famed cover three, which we know they love to sit in. But when you break down the zone splits even further, they've been bad in every split safety zone scheme, and cover three is actually the only split where they're above average. So you flip this around and you start to look at the matchup with Jared Goff, and he hasn't been very good against zone looks this year. When you just look at that on the surface, he's 25th in passing points earned against zone, 10 points earned, just one expected points added on 171 attempts. But again, if you look a little deeper at the splits, he's been atrocious against the split safety zone and actually pretty good against cover three. So there's sort of a little chicken and egg thing going on here. If the Seahawks go with what they do best and sit in their cover three bread and butter, they'll be playing a scheme against which Goff has been fifth in the NFL with 22 passing points earned. But if they attack the weakness, the split safety zones where Goff has -12 passing points earned on 57 attempts, then I think they're playing a scheme that doesn't suit what they do as well. So that's what I'm looking at in terms of the cat and mouse game. I was trying to dive deeper to see what goes on there. And I think you end up with this, we can either do what we're not that great at, and that's what they stink at, or we can do what we're really good at, and that's what they're a little bit better at.
I would say that the cat and mouse game for the Rams offense extends to just the question of running versus passing, because we know that the Rams like to run the ball. And the Rams are second in offensive DVOA running the ball and 15th passing the ball. But what Buffalo showed is, look, Seattle can stop the run. Just don't bother. Just don't bother running. Just pass the ball nonstop. Are the Rams willing to do that?
It seems at odds with everything that the Rams kind of are about in terms of the way that they're built. Now, there's, you know, the great research. You don't need to run to set up the play action and all that kind of stuff. But I mean, in terms of the offenses that you really think of that are predicated on, you know, establishing that zone run and then the play action off of it, McVay's on the top of the list.
I will say if the Rams do want to run in this game, they should run to the right, because Seattle is only 24th in adjusted line yards against runs that are listed as right tackle and only 31st against runs that are listed as right end. I think that may be now where Carlos Dunlap was going to be at left end. It was L.J. Collier before, and Dunlap is not really known as a run defender. Obviously, he's a man who gets to the passer and slaps down passes.
It'll be interesting. Goff, -22 passing points earned last time we saw him against the Dolphins. Just 3 passing points earned the two previous games combined against the Bears and the Niners. Seahawks pass defense is a big difference from that, so that might be what cures his ills if they can go heavy pass like the Bills did against the Seahawks. I doubt that McVay is going to feel so confident coming right out like that, coming off last time we saw Goff.
Yeah, and as far as the Seattle offense goes, I think this is another case of let Russ cook. Seattle's offense on first down is 2nd passing, and the Rams are 28th against the pass. But Seattle is 20th rushing, while the Rams are 4th against the run. So everything points to come out on first down and sling the rock.
And I think both teams are dealing with some banged up backfields in the run game. I don't know how much of an effect that'll have on either team, but I'm with you either way. Russ might have had his worst game of the season. No reason to think that's going to happen again.
No, there's no reason why that's not just a one game blip.
All right. Those are some of the better teams we'll be talking about this week. Let's talk about some of the interesting games for playoff odds.
Yeah, because the fact is, not every team that makes the playoffs is a great team. So the most important game for the playoffs is actually Monday Night Football, Minnesota at Chicago, not because of Minnesota, which only makes the playoffs 29% of the time if they win, but because of Chicago, which is 66% of the time in the playoffs if they win this game, but only 30% if they lose this game. And the funny thing about Chicago when I was looking into them is they started the season 3-1, but they were only -8% in DVOA. And then over the last 5 games, they've been at -24%, which is much better on defense, but they've only gone 2-3.
Yeah, it's been interesting. I wanted to kind of divert now because you actually just made me think of something. All of these odds are based on seven teams making the playoffs in each conference. There were the two kind of interesting, peculiar rule approvals that came through this week that I'm interested to hear your opinion on. One being that if games are canceled, we'll have eight teams in the playoffs from each conference. And the other one being the interesting sort of minority hiring rule, where for developing a high-level minority hire that gets hired by a different team, you would get compensatory draft picks in the third round. What did you make of these? I thought they were bizarre.
Yeah, the first one, I don't see where adding an eighth team to the playoffs and taking away the first round bye eliminates any of the unfairness of not having every team play 16 games. I feel like the two things are not connected. And I don't see where it adds any money in an expanding the playoffs add money way, because once you get over six playoff games in a weekend, you cannot broadcast them all in their own time period. Some of them are going to have to overlap, which means you're not really adding a lot of extra money.
Yeah, the money thing can't be that big. It seems to me like it's basically, because if it really was a big money thing, they would have just
done that in the first place, right?
So it seems to me like this is literally teams are worried that we're going to be 9-6, and there's going to be a team that's 10-6 that's going to win the division above us or make the playoffs above us. And we don't want to get left. Probably more likely to be like 8-7 or something like that. Then if there's an uneven number of games, you feel like it's less fair. So therefore you put more teams in. I don't know. Not particularly moving to me, but I guess I don't have a big beef against it. The other one I thought was really weird. It seems like they're protecting you from your division opponents poaching from your front office more so than they are actually promoting diversity in hiring.
It's really interesting. First of all, I would hope that teams that promote from within will also get the draft picks, right? If you promote someone of color from within your organization to a head coach or GM position, you should also get compensatory draft picks. It shouldn't be only when you hire them from another team that that team gets draft picks. If you develop them yourself and then just keep them, you should get draft picks. But you also wonder, would a team pause before hiring someone like Brian Flores because they don't want an in-division rival to suddenly get two compensatory draft picks?
Right. Like, do you rule out an AFC West team trying to hire Eric Bieniemy? Is that just kind of out of the question because of this? I think it might be. And that's really weird to me.
I mean, I understand the idea behind it, because the idea is the problem with minority hiring, or at least I think the biggest problem with minority hiring, is not enough minorities in lower down positions.
Right.
In particular, there are not enough minorities in offensive coaching positions that lead into head coaching positions, offensive coordinator and quarterback coach, right? We need more minorities, offensive coordinators and quarterback coach, because that's what tends to lead into head coaching positions these days. But I don't know if you can really give compensatory draft picks for hiring guys to those positions. So instead, what this does is it gives compensatory draft picks to developing guys in those positions.
I hope that the net positive, it's still a net positive all taken together. And I think that it probably is, but I do think it was a really bizarre way to address this. And from talking to some friends around the league, I've heard some interesting thoughts on it as well.
It basically seems like it starts by just handing Kansas City two draft picks, because we all agree Bieniemy is going to get a head job after this year.
He's got to. And Todd Bowles should be right up there as well.
Although Todd Bowles' defensive strategy against New Orleans leaves something to be desired. The idea that they decided they were going to play a bunch of soft zones against Drew Brees is not Todd Bowles' greatest day.
Yep. And you pretty much called it. You said, what was that? Death by a thousand.
Death by a thousand cuts.
That was certainly how it went. It happened quickly, though. All right, let's get back to this game. I'm sorry that we went in a different direction there. But as you pointed out, this was a Minnesota team that was 1-5. Chicago was 5-1. But DVOA never believed in the Chicago offense. And Minnesota's been the higher-ranked team of the two for a couple of weeks now.
Yeah, I think for most of the season, Minnesota has actually been the higher-ranked team of the two. And right now, we have Minnesota 14th and Chicago 17th.
And Dalvin Cook has been absolutely ridiculous. He finds himself on the midseason all total points team, which Mark Simon is writing about today. He leads the league with 30 total points earned from the running back position. And that Minnesota offense has found their kind of formula again, and it's less Kirk Cousins is better Kirk Cousins.
Yes, and here's the funny thing. Minnesota is first in rushing, first in adjusted line yards. Dalvin Cook is ruling everything in running backs. And yet, their passing game is still slightly more efficient than their running game by like 1.3%. Like, that's how much passing is more efficient than running. That even as good as Minnesota is running the ball, it's still slightly more efficient when they pass the ball. But I agree with you. Part of the reason why they can be that efficient is they pick their spots. And they also have really great wide receivers. Justin Jefferson is having a phenomenal rookie year, leads all receivers in DYAR.
Yeah, you know, one of the main things that we talk about in football analytics, like kind of broadly and strategically, is, okay, if on average passing is better than running, if on average you're going to get more yards this way, okay, we got to look at the volatility. There are sacks and interceptions. And even with that, we kind of look at it and we understand that almost every NFL team, if not all NFL teams, are still not at that equilibrium point where you'd say that they're passing enough to really be rational. This is kind of a great argument both for and against it right here, I think, when you get into the nuance of this debate, because as you just pointed out, even with Minnesota being so built as a running team and the best running team in the league, they're still more efficient passing than running. And without running as much as they do, their passing efficiency looks awfully different. That equilibrium point is still something that I think we haven't found as a community, and certainly on the field in the league. We don't have an efficient market there. It's just such a great example that you bring up of what that relationship actually looks like.
And it may be different. Minnesota may be at the right equilibrium point for them right now. But what's the right equilibrium point for Minnesota is not the right equilibrium point for Buffalo.
Oh, and that is for sure. The Buffalo offense,
right, is super pass heavy. Like, pass is so much better than run, right? It's very different from Minnesota. So what their run-pass ratio should be is also very different from Minnesota.
Right, and the Bears have been a struggle. They can't pass block. They can't run block. The quarterback situation's been terrible. David Montgomery's been a rare bright spot. He'll be coming off a concussion, so hopefully he can give the Bears something that, where they can compete with Dalvin Cook.
Yeah, but their run blocking isn't good, so it's not like they get Montgomery a lot of yards. They're 31st in run offense DVOA, even though Montgomery breaks tackles, because there's no holes for him after he breaks tackles.
Right, he's been really good, but altogether it hasn't mattered. The offensive line is going to be much more responsible for running back, running success than a running back alone can be.
Yeah, Chicago's offense is so meh in that they're bad, but they're not horrendous in a way that's easy to make fun of. They're just bad.
Oh, really? We can't make fun of the Bears' offense?
It's not like the Jets.
Yeah, they're not like the Jets. That's as much as you can say. But, man, they're really squandering a really good defense again. Roquan Smith, we talked about him in the past. They're just so good up front. He leads off-ball linebackers with 44 total points saved. And for his part, Eric Kendricks on the Vikings is not so bad. He's near the top of the list with 30 total points saved of his own. This should be an absolute defensive battle. At the end of the day, I can see a way that the Vikings can kind of control the game and move things. It's really harder for me to imagine a way that the Bears can do that just based on the way things have been going. I think they're running out of answers, and it's been a tough situation for them offensively.
No, the Bears' script to win this game is turnovers and putting Foles into good field position and then scoring like that way. I mean, they're fourth on defense. If they win a game, they win the game with their defense by keeping the other team down and by getting the turnovers to give the offense short field position.
Well, that'll require stopping Dalvin Cook, because Minnesota's, they'd prefer to control that clock and hang on to the ball. And, if I don't care how good your defense is, if you're on the field for 40 minutes, it's going to be a hard time. Interesting. I think there's a good chance we could come out of this one. You said this is mostly Bears when it comes to the playoff odds. We could come out of this week with the Vikings up to 29% and the Bears at 30%.
Yeah, they would basically be even if Minnesota beats Chicago in this game. And they would both be low, but they would be even. If Minnesota loses this game, 6%. So they're basically out.
They'd be basically out. And Chicago, for their part, this is the last chance you guys have to show us that you might be for real. All right, now the even more surprising last game to talk about this week. I'll admit it, this is one game where I've probably seen least amounts of film on either of these teams throughout the year than anybody else that we'll talk about.
Because nobody wants to watch them. But the fact is, the NFC East is going to get a playoff spot, which means the games between these teams end up having big playoff ramifications. So the next biggest game of the week is Philadelphia at the New York Giants. Philadelphia makes the playoffs 75% of the time if they win this game, 49% if they lose. The Giants, 24% with a win, 3% with a loss. So if they lose, their season is really over.
Yeah, I thought we were done talking about the New York teams a month ago. I think after this week, hopefully they can solidify it even more. On the Eagles side of things, which I think is really the only place to focus, they're getting slightly healthier, which has been a little bit of a positive for them. I think they can. There's more reason for optimism in the second half of the season than the first half. And if they take care of business in this game, they can basically lock up the division, or at least take the driver's seat, you know, a really strong hold on things in the division, just how bad everybody else has been. The hard thing to wrap my head around is still Carson Wentz. I've really been trying to search around and split things out different ways to get a better understanding of what's been going on with him this year. The best thing I could find is what's been on 0 and 1 step drops. So we break down all different drop types that you might have. A 0 to 1 step, you know, where you're basically just stepping and throwing the ball. A 3, a 5, a 7 step drop, rollouts, RPOs, screen passes, etc. And the one biggest split where we've seen a change from him is he was second in the league in 2019 in points earned on these 0 and 1 step drops. He had 31 points earned on 181 attempts, second only to Russell Wilson on those plays. Meanwhile, this year, there's been nobody worse than him. He drops all the way down to the bottom of the list. He's got negative 15 points earned on those 101 attempts. So it's the simplest types of throws. It's been the get the ball out your hands quick, something that he's been pretty good at. You know, when you look at what they were based around last year, it hasn't been to my surprise that on the 5 and 7 step drops that he's just fallen off a cliff and made these crazy bonehead plays. It's been on the simplest plays that you can have. So I'm really curious to see what is going on there, because it's one of the more bizarre splits that you could think of for somebody to really just fall off a cliff.
Yeah, and if I remember correctly, by the way, this was a big thing with Daniel Jones last year. Daniel Jones was really good at the 0 and 1 step drops, and then where he had problems were the 3s and the 5s and the 7s.
Yep, Daniel Jones, 22 points earned on those short drops last year. And he's actually continued to be good at that this year, right? So 103 attempts and 14 points earned on those for Daniel Jones this year. He's kind of been the same guy. It's not good if you can't do anything else well. Carson Wentz, who's otherwise been a good quarterback, has had kind of the strength of his game turn into the weakness.
Yeah, obviously also, right, part of the problem has been injuries. You know, Wentz has been bad, but he's not had a good offensive line to work with. Because of the injuries, and he's lost DeSean Jackson for most of the season. Travis Fulgham has had a breakout, but the Giants are very strong against opposing number one receivers because James Bradbury is having such a good season. And Bradbury, when these teams met 3 weeks ago, Bradbury covered Jackson most of the game, but in this game, I'm guessing he's going to be on Fulgham in most of the game.
Yeah, you'd think Fulgham would be the main guy. They are getting some guys back from injury. I think Jeffrey expected to play, so we could see what's going on there.
He's like Godot at this point, waiting for Alshon Jeffrey to actually get on the field.
Waiting for Godot. If you don't know the reference, definitely look that one up. One of my favorites.
I think people, you know, the funny thing is, it sounds weird to preview this game, but that Thursday night or 3 weeks ago, I mean, Wentz looked terrible for much of it, but they came back from 21-10 in the final 6 minutes. It was kind of exciting.
Yeah, you could say exciting in the sense of competitive. Good, I think, would be a different question. I'd really like to see Wentz straighten himself out, because he's been the biggest puzzle to me so far in 2020.
The Giants can like look at Daniel Jones and make a decision after the season. Do we think that, you know, he's the guy, or do we want to go another direction? The Eagles are stuck with Wentz. If this is for like good that he's going to be this bad, they're stuck.
That's true. And they already have invested in a plan B more so than the Giants have.
Right. They have a plan B, in which case they would have a young quarterback without any of the salary cap benefit of having a young quarterback.
I wonder what Wentz, if they decided to go the direction of trading Wentz, I wonder what he would gather, considering that you'd have to take that contract on too. There's still there's still a ton of upside here. He was almost the MVP. I don't know if he's damaged goods though.
Yeah, he just looks really bad this year.
All right, let's take a quick break, and we'll come back with Nathan Cooper to do an SIS Football Rookie Handbook NFL Draft Scouting Report.
All right, up next, we've got SIS Football Rookie Handbook Scouting Reports coming out. You got to check out the feature, by the way, on YouTube. We have all over YouTube, the SIS page, tons of film breakdowns on lots of prospects that are already in for the next version of the SIS Football Rookie Handbook. You can check that out at YouTube at the SIS page. Nate Cooper is back on right now to talk about Patrick Jones, the second edge rusher from Pittsburgh. Coop, what do we got here?
Yeah, this is a guy, 6'4", 260, good size, good build out on the edge. He's a big part of the Pitt defense. It has a lot of NFL talent on it. And this was a guy that had a solid season last year in 13 games, had 42 tackles, 8.5 sacks, 54 pressures, put up good numbers. And already in 8 games this year, he's got 32 tackles, 8 sacks, and 28 pressures as well. So putting up really good numbers and definitely carrying over a solid season from last year.
Yep, and looking at the YouTube video, as you break down this guy's game, I think you make the point pretty clear there that one of his biggest traits is his explosiveness. Words that come to mind when I watch him, twitchy. I love his counters in his pass rush game. He kind of mixes up a few different things, but really wins with that twitch, that explosiveness like you talk about. And then the sack production, you talked about it, 8.5 sacks and a whopping 54 pressures last year. He's already got 8 sacks this year, so on 28 pressures. So he's kind of increasing his sack to pressure ratio, if you will. I did notice on the film he seemed to be in on a lot of kind of near misses, like more a guy that's going to get in and kind of wreak havoc in the backfield than necessarily be a finisher. Is that the sense that you got from watching him, or do you think that's something that just kind of works itself out?
Yeah, it's something that I noticed last year as well. He's one of those guys. He's in on a lot of plays. Obviously, the production's there, but it could be even higher. There's a lot of times where, you know, he'll miss some tackles, miss some sack opportunities, and things like that, like you just mentioned.
Okay, so good length, good size for an edge or a defensive end, 3-4, 4-3, whatever it is. He's playing that same role. What do you see in this guy's game as you break it down on a deeper level?
Yeah, I mean, the explosiveness, like you said, that's one thing, one of the things that really stands out the most. His ability to get off the line quickly, he's really powerful, gets that long first step, and shows really heavy hands at the point of attack as well. Motor never stops. He's one of those guys that he's always showing pursuit to the football, getting around the edge and finding the ball carrier and really getting to it. There will be some times he shows a little bit of stiffness getting around the edge, but overall, the way he's playing, carrying over from last year to this year, I think he's a guy that you're not going to see past day two, whenever the draft comes around.
Yeah, clearly a top 100 player, maybe a first round type player. We'll see how the rest of things shake out and all the uncertainty that's going on right now. I'm with you, though. When you talk about that long first step, people listening that might not be as familiar might be wondering why that's important. Something that we're constantly talking about is getting depth as a defensive lineman or as an edge rusher. How much depth do you get with your first step? How much do you penetrate into the offensive line sort of territory? The quicker and the deeper you can get right away, that's a big part of the pass rush game right there. So when you talk about indicators of explosiveness and guys that can really be disruptors, that's something that we're constantly looking for. Another thing that I love, the way this guy, the ankle bend, you know how I am with my ankle benders, and you see it just all over the film with this guy.
Absolutely. He's a guy that he's definitely fun to watch. He's all over the field. And I'm ready to see him the rest of the season as well.
Nathan Cooper, thank you for coming back on. Check it out on YouTube. That's Patrick Jones, the second, the Pittsburgh edge rusher. You can check all of the SIS film breakdowns out on our YouTube page, and it's all feeding into the SIS Football Rookie Handbook, where we've got how many reports in already?
We've got over 300 reports in. We're really digging deep, and it'll be well over 500 by the time the season ends.
College football season might be a little bit late, but we won't be. Nate, keep up the great work, and we'll talk to you again soon.
I appreciate it, Matt.
All right, thank you to all of the listeners. Please remember to tell your friends about the Off the Charts Football Podcast. Subscribe, rate, review, all that good stuff. You can check out footballoutsiders.com for all their great content. Aaron, what do you got on footballoutsiders.com this week?
Film Room looks at Tua Tagovailoa's first two starts. He looks very good so far. Walkthrough tells you what we're going to be saying about Tua and Justin Herbert 10, 15 years from now. and a good scramble for the ball breakdown on that whole expanded eight teams in the playoffs thing and whether it makes any sense.
Super duper fun Tua versus Herbert game. I think there'll also be a Tua versus Burrow game later in the year. These three rookie quarterbacks are giving us some real reasons for optimism looking forward.
Yeah, I mean, I'm trying to not jump to conclusions about Tua because it's one good game. He had one bad game and one good game. And you don't want to jump to conclusions after one early good game or else you start raving about Kyle Allen. But he did look really good in that one game.
I think there were a lot of people that were very excited to rave about him, that were looking for any reason to rave about him. And when they had it, they were going to go do it. I'm with you. You got to temper the enthusiasm.
Yeah, the Dolphins have improved, though, significantly over the last few weeks on both sides of the ball. And they may be real actual playoff contenders.
They're in the top 10 of the DVOA list, right?
Yeah. I mean, the only reason that I don't have them as a top playoff, a good playoff contender at this point is because in the playoff odds, we're kind of dinging them for Tua's poor projection because he's a first-round pick with only two games of experience. But if he continues to play the way that he did against Arizona, their chances will go up. Right now, we have them at 56% to make the playoffs.
What's encouraging, I think, from that Arizona game, the speed of the game didn't look like too much for Tua. It looked like he really took to the NFL pace of the way that things were going and was able to translate what we saw from him and were excited in college to the NFL. What I think did stand out even with that, though, is just how much faster Kyler Murray is than Tua. Like, you look at these kind of similar stature quarterbacks and you might think the skill sets are the same. Kyler Murray is so freaking fast.
Kyler Murray is on pace to break the all-time record for rushing value by our stats, which is currently held by Randall Cunningham in 1990 for quarterback rushing value.
Randall Cunningham still hanging on to it over any of the Vic years.
Yeah, Lamar Jackson last year is second.
Awesome. All right. Check out Sports Info Solutions on Twitter. We're at sportsinfo_SIS. And you can check out the free SIS Data Hub to find many of the stats that we talked about today. That's at sisdatahub.com. You can also check out sisbets.com, where we have prop betting recommendations for you. The best way to kind of beat the odds is to go where the casinos don't put their efforts, and that is on the prop bets. So if you want nice, easy money, check out sisbets.com. You can get a free trial and make some prop betting money. For my co-host, Aaron Schatz, and our producer, Justin Stein, I'm Matt Manicharian, and thank you for joining us for the latest episode of the Off the Charts Football Podcast.